Good morning, and welcome to this month's Hancock Horizon Investments Economic Update Call. Hancock Horizon Investments provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. The opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions, please email them to david.lundgren@hancockbank.com, and I'll take them at the end of the call. On today's call, we have Chief Investment Strategist John Portwood and Investment Directors David Lundgren, Greg Hileski, Richard Chauvin, and Jeffrey Tankus. And with that, I'll pass it on to David Lundgren, who will be the moderator.
Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone. Welcome to this month's edition of our Market and Economic Update Call. John, we'll go ahead and start with you. And last week, we got the first number of the second quarter GDP, and it came in a little bit weaker than expected. Obviously, a very familiar theme that we've been experiencing for several years now. The report came in at 1.2%. I think many economists thought that number would be more in the mid-twos, low-twos. So a bit of a disappointed. Two more revisions to go. We'll see how that number shakes up from a final perspective. But all in all, not all that outstanding. And I think based on some preliminary reports that I read, the primary culprit was global trade, but I'll let you elaborate on that a little bit. Tell me about the second quarter.
Okay, Dave. Let me make some comments about the specifics of the last quarter, and then I'll make some comments about trend, long-term trend, going back to 2008. As you mentioned, people were looking for a mid 2% growth of GDP in the current quarter, and as it turns out, the bottom line measurement that the BEA looks at in terms of economic activity was about 2.3%. Real final sales of domestic product is what they call that, but they made a fairly large inventory adjustment, and there were some trade figures involved too, but a lot of it was an inventory adjustment for the quarter, indicating that manufacturers and businesses were reducing inventory more than anticipated over that time period. And that's what pushed us down to a 1.2% growth rate from what had been anticipated being a 2.3. This was the third consecutive quarter where you had a drop in commercial investment. Consumer spending was good. In fact, some people say that's really the only redeeming part of this report was that consumer spending remained pretty good. Unfortunately, when you analyze the consumer spending part of the report, it indicates that a lot of that came from just a decrease in household savings. So it was a pretty lackluster quarter. It wasn't completely negative, again, in that real final sales of domestic product were at a plus 2%, which is kind of what the economy has been running on here for quite some time. But while income did improve a little bit also, along with the real final sales number during the quarter, the indicator for income growth is still not particularly good. And here I'm going back away to the second quarter of 2008 coming forward during the lion's share of the recovery. The real per capita disposable income number is up only 6% in total since that time period. So we've got roughly 8 years of 1% compound annual growth in inflation adjusted per capita disposable income, which of course is quite low and certainly considerably below what you might expect coming out of a major credit bust historically. But, of course, there are other structural factors involved that have intervened to produce the situation that we're currently in. Going back to, say, 7-8 years ago, people who have listened to us on this call for a while know that we were talking about 2% growth rates overall in GDP growth rather than the 3 we had become used to on a trend basis in the past because of demographics, debt, a lot of things that were not really factored in completely, I guess, by a lot of economists as the recovery began. And it looks like those things are still with us, because if you look at real quarterly GDP, compound annual rate of change, for the last 10 years, it's only 1.2%. The decline, really, from the 3% average began during the 2008 recession and has continued to slowly decline since then. Prior to 2008, you could look back, really, with the exception of one incident during a recession in the mid-1980s, to a 10-year annualized growth rate of GDP that was roughly 3%. And that hasn't been the case, of course, since 2008. It looks like it's declining again. The 10-year moving average now is about 1.3%. Certainly, far below what we've been used to in the past. In terms of historic trend, you go back to World War II and just do a simple trend line regression analysis of where we would be had it not been for the credit bust and all of these structural issues we face, from demographics and a decline in the labor force and too much debt, et cetera, we're about 15% below trend. The economy now would be estimated, I guess, about a $20 trillion economy, and based on the current analysis, it's about a $16.5 trillion economy in total goods and services produced during the year. So a lot of things have changed. It doesn't look like it's getting appreciably better. And the world is, I suppose, beginning to adjust to the fact that growth is not only slower now than anticipated, but it might be slow for quite some time. And because of that, we've created some issues from the standpoint of employment and income growth in the developed economies, particularly Europe and the U.S. And Brexit partly reflects the concern in a lot of quarters about what is happening to income growth for the man in the street, so to speak. People that have owned a lot of assets, people who have been in industries that have benefited significantly from the recovery since in 2008, that were certainly helped a lot by quantitative easing around the world, are not particularly happy. And while the Brexit vote was, to a degree, concerned with immigration issues, a lot of it had to do with nationalism, I guess, versus globalism, in that surely there's something we can do on a national basis to improve income and improve jobs by perhaps instituting some restrictions on trade or doing some other things that might be more beneficial to us and not necessarily place the working classes at the mercy of something that's happening elsewhere in the world. Well, that sort of anti-establishment and anti-globalization feeling is not limited to Europe. It's also going on here. Some of you may not have read this particular article, but Bernie Sanders wrote an op-ed in the New York Times back in June, I believe, in which he asked, could this rejection of the current form of the global economy happen in the United States? You bet it could. So he goes on to talk about what he thinks is going on and how he thinks things should be changed, because the global economy is not working for the majority of the people in our country and the world and so forth and so on. To the extent that feeling impacts politics and economic decisions, it's not going to be particularly attractive, or let's just say it might cause some extra volatility in the economy and some more uncertainty as we move forward into the election, and it calls into question whether or not globalization and basically free trade policies that currently exist will move to something else. And that's kind of where we are. It looks like it's slow growth, a great deal of uncertainty going forward, and some of the uncertainty might be resolved by the results of the election, and then again, perhaps not, because this particular issue seems to be really controlling a lot of what happens in the political realm, regardless of of which party ends up in power after the election. And that's kind of the story, Dave, of where we are. It looks like more of the same in terms of recession. The odds still favor avoiding recession at this point, at least for the next 6 months. But the leading indicators are softer than they used to. And, at best, it looks like the current trends are going to exist for a while. I might mention one other thing in terms of reflation or trying to drive the economy higher. The cries for additional monetary stimulus, perhaps radical stimulus, and the cries for a lot of fiscal policy, infrastructure spending, what have you, are now growing louder, and that's something else that might be the outcome of the election in terms of attempts to add more stimulus to the economy, which, again, are questionable. Nobody really knows whether that'll work or whether it won't or whether it'll just simply add to more distortions. But it's unfortunate that we're in this kind of world with so much uncertainty, but it looks like we're going to have to deal with it for a while longer.
Okay. Thank you, John. And I'm going to ask Richard to expand on the anti-globalization sentiment that we're seeing across the globe. And really, hopefully everybody's been paying attention. If you haven't watched the news in 2 years, there's a big election coming up at the end of the year. And one thing, there's a lot of rhetoric on, obviously, what candidates want to do, and some of them they can, some of they can't. Trade is actually, there's a lot of power regarding trade when it comes to the executive branch. And it's been a big campaign theme, and I think it'd be important, Richard, maybe just to touch on that a little bit, on what the power of the president really has in regards to those particular issues that could have a major impact on economic growth on a going-forward basis. So I'll turn it over to you, Richard.
Thank you, Dave. And, this is a very interesting topic and one that I think you'll find where the president has a considerable amount of power. We've identified six different situations in which the president is able to act without Congress in any congressional action at all. So I'm going to hit on those just briefly, the six different situations that occur. First of all, one of the things the president can do is that if the Commerce Department believes that there's been currency manipulation, which would obviously make one nation's goods more competitive versus another, then the president can act to can declare that there's been currency manipulation, and if there's been an injury to a nation, to our nation, as a result of this, the president can impose some tariffs or duties on some imported goods, and so that's fairly open-ended, but it basically requires the Commerce Department to declare that there's been currency manipulation. One of the things, of course, we've heard in the past is that China's been accused of this over a number of years, which, of course, they deny. Then there's an International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which exists. And in this particular case, the president can actually declare a national emergency with respect to the threat to national security, to foreign policy, or to the U.S. economy. And it allows the president to regulate, prevent, or prohibit foreign economic transactions, which includes imports or exports, as well as certain currency and transfers of credit. So again, that's an act that exists that the president can act on his own. Next, the president might seek to remedy a balance of payment deficit. These are things that have occurred in the past and have caused some stress. We've been in a situation in the past with regard to our oil imports where we've had a significant balance of payment deficit. In a case where the U.S. believes, or the president believes, that the U.S. has a significant balance of payments problem, he can impose an import surcharge of up to 15% or a quota on imports or some combination of those two things to deal with this balance of payment deficit. One thing to note is that this authority is prohibited from being abused by and used to protect a domestic industry from import competition. That's a really difficult thing to determine, but the president has the ability to determine that unilaterally. Next, a fairly open-ended method the president can use is he can impose restrictions on imports that threaten to impair our national security based on an investigation by the Commerce Secretary. Obviously, the Commerce Secretary is in the cabinet, works for the president, but if the Commerce Secretary basically states there is a national security issue, the president can impose restrictions on imports. Pretty open-ended. Next, the president might seek relief from import volume increases. So if the president believes that there's been an unusual or unnecessary increase in imports which harms a particular industry, he has the ability to seek relief for that industry so that the industry have a chance to adjust to it, and he can impose tariffs or quotas on that on those imports. Now, first, the International Trade Commission must investigate and determine whether there's actually been an injury to this industry first. And finally, the president may enforce U.S. rights in response to foreign trade practices. This allows the U.S. trade representative, once he or she has determined that a foreign act or policy or practice is unreasonable or discriminatory and burdens or restricts U.S. commerce, he or she has the ability to suspend, withdraw, or prevent the application of trade agreements or to carry out a trade agreement, to impose duties or other restrictions, or take any feasible and appropriate action under the authority of the president. So those are the six ways the president can act. As you see, he has pretty broad authority. And I'll end by saying a couple things. First, with regard to existing trade agreements that were created by an act of Congress, the president cannot dispose of those or do away with those or not act in accordance with those without congressional action. So these things that I've mentioned, other than that, do not affect or not affected by existing trade agreements. And finally, I'll point out that even though all these particular powers were put in place to protect our national interest, in some case our national security, there's always a risk that they can be misused and can cause significant negative economic effects if they're used inappropriately. And Dave, that's the story on trade.
Okay, interesting, and something we'll have to continue to monitor. As mentioned before, it could have a major impact on future economic growth. So obviously the election is important regarding trade on a going forward basis. Greg, let's talk about the stock market a little bit. And on our last call, of course, Brexit occurred at the end of June. We had quite a bit of volatility the 5 days following. And then as we entered July, saw some steady improvement in the market, at least the first half of July for sure. Things started to level out a little bit as we entered the latter part of July. But all in all, pretty strong month, refreshing to see, much needed. Tell us a little bit about the month and where we're going from here.
Yeah, I think it was a surprise for everyone. There was really, as you said, July ended up being a good month with stock indices not only domestically but also internationally in positive territory, which I think surprised a lot of people because that whole UK Brexit issue, you know, seemed to be, at least from our standpoint, more of a European issue or a UK issue than it was so much, you know, it wasn't going to really impact the U.S. economy. So, yeah, a lot of angst about that vote, and, you know, again, I think the market in general thought that they would remain in, and but the polls were neck and neck, and when it came right down to it, the people voted to leave. So, you know, it resulted in a couple days of market declines, but then market stabilized. The for the month, the Dow actually finished up 2.9%, so almost 3%. The S&P even a little bit better. It was up 3.7%. And then dipping down into the mid-cap and small-cap stocks, they posted even better returns than the larger indices, both mid-cap and small-cap, returning 4.3% and 5.1% respectively. Again, surprisingly, at least from my standpoint, international developed markets were up 5.1%. And emerging markets were up slightly less, but still nonetheless in positive territory, returning 4.8%. Australian stocks were the best performing region internationally, returning 7% for the month. In terms of strong U.S. sector performance, the best sector was tech stocks. They were up about 7.9%, which is a pretty darn big number for a month, followed again by materials and healthcare at 5.1% and 4.9% respectively. The lowest performing sectors, and we had three sectors for the month that were negative out of the 10, energy down 1.9%, consumer staples a negative 0.71%, and then utilities a negative 0.69%. You had referenced volatility also, and right after the vote, we actually saw that volatility index, which is the Chicago Board Options Exchange, and it's a pretty good index indicator of short-term expected volatility. And I think it hit above something like the 53% level or something, or 53. But since the June 24 spike, it's actually come down by over 50%. And I think right as of yesterday, we were at about just under 12. So one of the other bright spots toward the end of July was the retail sales report that came in for June, coming in fairly strong. On a year-over-year basis, sales grew by about 2.7%. So the U.S. consumer seems to be doing their part to try and prop up the economy. And just to remind everyone that U.S. GDP is roughly two-thirds consumption. That's what consumers buy and sell. You and I go out and buy. So as long as I think people, you know, don't retract and pull back and continue to purchase goods and services, that could bode well for future earnings, which have really been stagnant to negative for the last four quarters. So some think we're going to have a rebound in this latter half of 2016, but, you know, we'll see. At least right now, looking at a chart of the trends of earnings per share growth, it looks like it could be flattening out or moderating. All in all, I think the month of July was strong, probably for a couple of reasons. I still think that there's some continued optimism for the economy. You know, it's a mixed economic bag. If you do look at the ISM survey, which is the manufacturing index, which looks at employment and inventories and production, it seems to be pretty positive. So I think, you know, there's some light there. But then again, we do have a mixed bag sometimes. Anyway, the other thing I think that's probably driving it is that with the whole Brexit vote, that has really kind of put the U.S. Federal Reserve back into hold mode. And, of course, the other global central banks are also continue to be accommodative in terms of monetary policy. And, of course, when we were on a quantitative easing, we saw, you know, huge gains in the stock market. So I think, you know, that probably has a lot to do with having such a strong month in stocks. Not to end the whole discussion on a negative note, but I still think, you know, what concerns us in terms of our outlook is that if you look at stock valuations, P.E. ratios are still pretty pricey. If you look historically for probably the last several decades, they're falling in the top quartile of historical P.E.s. So certainly, if we do get some earnings growth, that will help bring those down, and I think it would, you know, give us some comfort in terms of that, in terms of valuation. And then also, just looking at the month of August, I ran across an interesting statistic. And, of course, when you come off such a good month like we did in July, you know, you could kind of expect that you may not have a good August. But I forget who was calculating this, but they also said that the month of August has been one of the worst performing months for the S&P 500 since 1991. So we may be flat for this month. And I think, again, it'll be interesting to see what the political landscape adds to the markets. And we'll see if things play out.
Thanks, Greg. Jeff, you heard Greg's comments on stocks, and I think what may even be more volatile than the stock market is the possibility of a Fed rate increase. Right after Brexit, I remember that the couple days that followed, a lot of analysts that follow the Fed said that they would be on hold till 2018. And then about a week or two later, as economic data firmed up, stock market improved. 2016 was back on the table, and then the Fed met, kind of confirming that that was a real possibility. Then we got the GDP report, and now it's not as likely that we see something. I think it's still on the table that we see an increase in 2016. Help us figure all this out.
Well, it's been a tough month, as you say, for the Federal Reserve. You couldn't have more packed into 30 days than the Brexit vote, the tremendous decline in interest rates after that, the rally, basically the risk-on rally in stocks after that, and the return to interest rates back up to almost where they were prior to the Brexit vote, and then the GDP number, as you say. So it's been a roller coaster ride for the Fed. Generally speaking, the Fed came out, they met, the meeting in June was June 15th, so the Brexit vote was June 27th. They met again in July, on July 27th, and they did pretty much what they've done all along in that they tried to talk a good game. They came out and said that things were generally better than they had been before, that the economy continued to improve. Some Fed watchers interpret that to mean that they are still looking hard at a September rate increase. We've said all along we didn't think a September rate increase was in the cards. I tend to think that they would want to avoid a rate increase before the election. However, looking back historically, they have on occasion done that in the past. So it isn't without precedent that they raise in September. But I think common sense tells us that they'd want to avoid it if possible. The more likely scenario in my mind is that they raise sometime in December. The Fed definitely wants to raise. It wants to get out of this near zero interest rate policy. Unfortunately, reality keeps rearing its ugly head here with GDP numbers and Brexit votes and other things around the world, not the least of which is the fact that John touched on it, the fact that virtually every other country around the world is going the opposite direction. They're still rolling out massive stimulus programs. Europe is working on a plan, an asset buyback plan, where they basically just start buying back junk assets as well as equities, all sorts of things, so that they could put money into the economy and hopefully get things going. So the Fed has a tough row to hoe here. But I think at the end of the day, they want to raise interest rates. There are some votes now in the voting Fed governor block that want to raise rates, that have actually voted to raise rates. So it is coming unless we get some other really disappointing news. I think another Fed increase is in the cards somewhere, but probably not December, and certainly not more than one this year for sure. So we'll have to stay tuned to see exactly how this all works out. But if the economy doesn't improve from this recent report that we got, it is going to be very difficult for them politically to increase rates.
Jeff, let's talk about the longer end of the curve. The theme, I guess, is lower for longer. Talk a little bit about the move that we saw in the latter part of June into July, specifically with the 10-year.
Well, the 10-year before Brexit was about 1.75%. It had been moving up a little bit, I think, in anticipation of a vote for England to stay in the EU. Of course, Brexit changed all that. Rates dropped about 40. I guess that's about 40 basis points down to 1.35% when everybody thought that the world was really going to slow down dramatically. And then cooler heads have prevailed. Rates have moved up. This morning we're seeing another little tick up, and we're back about 1.55%. It looks like there is going to be something of a lid on Treasury rates, though, going forward. It's going to be tough for rates to rise a whole lot between now and say the end of the year. So we could see some modest move up in rates, but for the most part, we're likely to stay in this range. And this is really the range that we've been in for some time. If you took the Brexit vote out of the equation, we've been around 1.5% to call it 1.75% for some time now. So this is likely where we're going to stay. Probably the bright spot in the fixed income world continues to be the muni market. They didn't see the big decline in yields, which is pretty customary when the Brexit vote took place. So they still have some value, although what we've seen lately is we started to see money flowing back into those funds. So it is bidding up the prices of municipal bonds and slowly taking some of the attractiveness out of municipal securities. But at this point, they still remain one of the better values out there in the fixed income world.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff, and thank you, everyone, for joining us today. Please join us next month when we meet again on Tuesday, September 6th. Have a great day.